My name is Michelle Owu and I'm carrying out this interview on behalf of the Wellcome Trust for the One Another project. The date today is the 19th of August 2009 and the time is now 5:17 p.m. Could you tell me your name, your age and where you come from, please?
My name is Sue Griffith, I'm 56 and I'm from Swansea in South Wales.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm fine.
Did you come down to Swansea this late morning?
Yeah, I arrived about lunchtime.
What have you been up to?
Just met a couple of work colleagues who are going to come and watch me later on and sat in a shady cafe because it's very hot and had a coffee and just talked about how nervous I was feeling and they tried to calm me down a bit.
And how are you feeling now?
I'm fine. I have a little bit of a stomach flipping going on. It'll just help the adrenaline, hopefully.
Are you looking forward to it?
Yes, I am.
Can you remember how you first heard about the project?
Well, I'm a lecturer, I teach art history, so I was aware of the fourth plinth and everything that's been going on in contemporary art on there over the last few years. And I was giving a lecture and researching that for the first time in May. And when I was on the fourth plinth website, I noticed that you could apply for the Anthony Gormley piece One and Other, and since I was encouraging all my students to apply, I thought I'd better put my money where my mouth is. So I did, and lo and behold, I got a place, which some of them don't know about because they'd all gone on their leave by then. So when I go back in September, they will be pretty main, I think.
And the people that do know that you're doing it, what's been their reaction?
Yeah. I think they just have been a bit worried for me and saying, you know, oh, how high is it and will you be okay and what are you going to do is one of the main reactions. But I think they're all very excited. I've had some great support, actually. People have been very positive about it.
What was specifically about this project that appealed to you, do you think?
There's something so absolutely sort of democratic about it, I suppose. You know, the idea that anybody could apply and anybody could take part in this, and you know, and I think the selection procedure has been a relatively random one, and I just think it's a brilliant idea. Rather than looking at a piece of static sculpture, you know, I suppose it's that old thing of the idea that somehow when art sits in a gallery, as other people have said in the past, it's almost like a museum. Like it's the art is not living; it's already had its life, and here it is preserved in the gallery or museum. And this is something quite different from that because it's a thing that is living and ongoing. And while there will be a record of it afterwards, it's just got a vitality to it, I suppose, that's quite different from producing something from a material.
Can you tell me a bit more about what you're going to be talking about?
Okay, well, having gone through all various different ideas, I ended up with coming back to basics and saying, okay, you've got to think about what you do, what is important to you. And what I do is teach art history, so most of my my lectures are about an hour long, so I'm used to the timing of things to talk for an hour. And I thought, well, really, I ought to deliver an art history lecture when I'm up there. But I wanted to write something new, and then I had to think about what were the basic things that were important to me. And one of those things is women, because I guess I'm a bit of a feminist and because I'm gay, so I reckon women had to be in there, and I teach a lot about gender and things in my work. And the other slightly off-beam thing that came to me was my cats and how much I love my two cats. And so it's been completely new research for me to look at the idea of combining these. And then I thought, well, actually, all those ingredients, those three ingredients of art history, women and cats, are already going to be there in that square, because I will be a work of art while I'm up there, or part of one. I am a woman. And then we have Lancia's lions that are on the square guarding Nelson's column. And I thought, yep, this is definitely telling me something. All the ingredients are there. So,
which artists are you going to talk about?
Oh, all sorts, including unknown ones like, you know, Egyptian goddess statues, so we don't know who produced them. going right through to things like medieval manuscripts, and then through to things like a statue that is in London of Hodge, Samuel Johnson's cat, who made our first dictionary. He obviously was a great lover of cats. Sexy cats like the cat in Manet's Olympia that arches its back and lurks in the corner. Cats by women artists who interestingly give the cat full credibility by making paintings that are entirely about the cat and not just in the painting with a figure. But you know, cats are, once you start looking for them, they start cropping up all over the place. You know, they're in Dürer's Adam and Eve. There's a cat sitting in the bottom with Eve. David Hockney's Mr. and Mrs. Clark with Percy. All sorts of things. Hogarth, one of his prints that is about cruelty, the four stages of cruelty, has got examples of cruelty to animals in it. All sorts.
Have you had a lot of fun researching this?
Yes, great fun. In fact, I'm thinking there could be at least enough for a PhD here and a book or something.
Is that something you'd like to do?
I don't know. I mean, it's intrigued me. I've come up with one sort of quite original idea, I think, that is a take entirely of my own, that is about the whole idea of Baudelaire writing in the 19th century. There's this strong idea that all art historians know about if you research Impressionism, that he came up with this idea of the flâneur, who was the sort of the dandy, the stroller through life, and it marked that change from when art was up until that point a lot about classicism, and he made the plea for modernism, which was that art should be about life as you see it around you. And everybody says, because Baudelaire was the translator of Edgar Allan Poe's works, that he based the idea of the flâneur on the figure of the detective. But I actually think he based it on the cat, because the more I look into it, Poe and Baudelaire were both massive cat lovers. Poe wrote a story called The Black Cat. Baudelaire wrote two poems called The Cat. And apparently Baudelaire used to be such a cat lover, he would go in people's houses and not talk to the people. He used to get quite upset about it. He'd spend all his time talking to the cat. And he said his inner authentic self was a strolling cat. And I'm absolutely convinced that he has based the idea of the flâneur at least as much on the cat as he has on the detective. And I've not seen anybody else write that. So that's my original idea as part of this. And I'm convinced there's more there that can be followed up.
You've got a cat yourself.
I've got two, yeah.
Tell me about your cat.
My cat, oh dear. Joe's a ginger cat, and Blackie is a black cat. I've discovered that black cats are much harder to home than other cats. That legacy still lingers on of the idea that black cats, the association with witches, oh, what's more to say? I don't know. I, you know, they're great. They're part of my life. Because I'm single, I know I've got that stigma of the spinster who lives with cats, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
Sorry. Is there something the flâneur about either of your cats?
The flâneur. Yeah, I think there's a bit of the flâneur in all cats because they, what is it? Rudyard Kipling said the cat walks by itself. And I think all cats do. They won't do as you tell them. They're not like dogs who have a master and can be taught to obey. Cats will do their own thing. They are natural artists. Natural. I think in my talk I call them leftist rebel cats because I think that's how they are. You know, they just do their own thing and they walk where they will, and they won't be controlled. I think that's the interesting thing about when I get to the end of the talk is, through all of these images of cats, you learn nothing about cats, because cats have changed very little from when the Egyptians kept them as domestic pets. What we learn is about the way that we have thought about cats and the way we've behaved and treated them and used them to symbolise different things and have condemned them or revered them.
Do you think there are obvious parallels with feminism?
I do, absolutely. I think very often, particularly in the 19th century, when writers are talking, male writers mainly, are talking about cats and the way they caress them and touch them and those kind of things, they're really talking about women. There's that kind of slippage between the way that they're writing about cats and writing about women. And it's quite clear that they're slipping quite easily between the two of them. There's a confusion there.
Also picking up on what you were saying about spinsters and witches having cats. Mm. Where do you think this, you mentioned it earlier on, where do you think this link between spinsters and cats comes from?
I don't know. It's an odd one. I think there's a lot of connection with the idea of the home and this idea that, well, it's two things really. It's the idea that people who lavish their love on cats are perhaps doing it because they have no one else to give their love to, which I think is completely wrong. But it's also the fact that women and cats have been so strongly associated with the home. There's a proverb that goes right back to medieval times, which is man for the barn, women and cat. No, man and dogs for the barn, women and cats for the kitchen. So it seems like that, what's strongly been put together is the idea that women and cats have their place, and their place is under men, and their place is in the home, in the kitchen. But I think what's also going on is that men have been a little bit frightened of the cat's independence. You know, maybe it is precisely the cat's and women's refusal to obey that is the thing that has been so problematic. And when I talk about how the whole witch thing came about, it's through Christianity attacking paganism, because in paganism is goddess worship, and Christianity is about male power, or God's power, but men who write God's word. So it's really with Christianity that women and cats both start to get a really hard time. But I guess that association is about their place being the same place, the place in the kitchen, doing their duty for men.
How would you paint a picture of yourself? How would you describe yourself as a person?
Tricky one. Don't know. I think I've got quite a strong character. I've had to cope with a number of things in my life. I always feel, because I'm an only child, that I've grown up with that idea, and my father wasn't around when I was growing up, and I learned a lot from my mother about the idea that, you have to make your own way in life, and you don't look for help from others. You have to be strong and take it on the chin, and I suppose I've always felt that need to be strong in my life, and I suppose I feel I've done that. But I think I'm quite a sociable person as well. My students tell me I'm anyway.
What's important?
And I've helped them
to
a lot. What's important to me
in life at the moment?
Peace, I think. Peace of mind, health. Those kind of things. I think even more than, people use that word happiness, but I think contentment is a much greater thing, and it's kind of, I think I've had a lot of ups and downs in life, and I think I'm reaching that point in my life when I appreciate just that idea of a steady contentment. Maybe it's cats are teaching me that, I don't know, because they have it, they have that gift to be content. I think that's quite important. I went through a bit of a sort of watershed in my life back about 7 years ago. I got breast cancer, and I lost my mum in the same year. And it was quite a difficult year, 2002. And one of the things that I think is part of why I feel it's important for me, this plinth thing, is that when my mum died, she knew that I was having chemo at the time. I'd lost all my hair, so I couldn't keep it from her. And she was dying over a period of 6 months, and we both knew that. And I think, sorry, sounds terribly maudlin, but I think I have a distance from it now, I can talk about it. And my big regret is that she died not knowing that I would survive it. I had a mastectomy the month after she died. And so there's kind of a bit in me, because I don't really believe in afterlives or anything like that, but there's a bit that still sits in me with this idea that I wish she could know. So there's a little part of me that still kind of talks to her in a sense of feeling that I want to sometimes tell her that I'm still here. And I guess there was this sense of not only am I here, but I'm going to be here in evidence in a really big way, because I'm not just here, I'm going to be on a plinth in Trafalgar Square, you know. And I suppose that the whole kind of presence of that, you know, a whole hour of fame, you know, it's kind of connected with that for me in a way. It's not about a big presence of being out there with loads of people. It's about a little internal dialogue that I'm having with her of, look, I'm still around and look where I am.
When you were growing up, were you always interested in pictures or art, or painting and drawing?
Yep, I think when I was 8, I came to live in Essex with my mum. And I'd been looked after very largely by my gran up until that point. There's a picture I've got quite clearly in my mind, which is of myself in a gabardine mac with my mum in Trafalgar Square, looking a bit frightened because the pigeons are going around me. And it's quite a kind of key photograph for me, because it represents the point at which my mum started looking after me much more. Because before that, she'd been living up in London and sending money back for my gran to look after me. And I remember when I was 8, one of those things she did was take me in the National Gallery. And I even remember the painting that I fell in love with at 8 when I was in there, which is a little Italian painting by Murillo of a peasant boy leaning on a sill. And I suppose because he was about my own age, I was kind of identifying with this painting of a child. I don't think I'd ever really seen any paintings, only reproductions before that. And so I suppose that the die was cast then, you know, and it stayed with me. Yeah.
Was it difficult to be separated from her while you were living with your grandma?
No, I think, you know, I think when you're a child, you're so sort of biddable. I think you just go along with whatever's happening. You know, I questioned it, which seems odd, but no, I don't think I did. It was just, that's what life was. You know, I think until you reach your teenage years, you don't really question those kind of things.
You said before you were interested in the social aspects of art history. Can mm-hmm. you just expand on that a bit more?
Well, when I did my MA at Leeds, and the course that I did is specifically called The Social History of Art, because it placed an emphasis on the idea of not just looking at artworks for the sake of, you know, looking at the movement that they came out of, the aesthetic of them and those kind of things, but to actually really question things about them in terms of the way that they'd been used, maybe the way that they spoke to us about things like class very strongly with art always, and gender and those kind of associations. But it was always a kind of interest of mine as well, I think, because I didn't want to just be one of those kind of art historians who was interested in talking about, you know, the beautiful brushwork and those kind of things. What interested me always about art was what it meant to the people who looked at it. You know, so it's very much about, I suppose, the way that art takes its place, as all culture does, in meaning. You know, it has an ideology always, and it teaches us certain things about the way we are. And I think this is true of what I'm doing today, because it's telling us things. It's not just pigs of cats. It's telling us things about the way we think about cats. But it's actually really not telling us anything about cats. It's telling us things about us as people. Not always very good things, I have to say. Because sometimes they're imaging cats in a way. It's not just people painting cats because they love cats. They're painting them to symbolise all sorts of quite dark things sometimes as well. So there are lessons to be learned, I think, from images of cats.
What will you do with this lecture? What will you do with all that material?
Oh, God, I don't know. I have a work colleague who I've just discovered, he works with me and is doing his MA with me, and he suddenly got into cats because he's a big cat lover, but he's an illustrator, so he's looking at cats in illustration and folklore kind of thing, and I'm looking forward to having a good dialogue with him when I go back after the summer. I think I'll definitely have to repeat this lecture in the lecture theatre when I go back for everybody who's missed it.
Which university did you?
Swansea Metropolitan University. It's only recently become a university, actually. We've got two universities now in Swansea.
Are they undergraduates that you teach?
Yes, they are, yeah. They're nearly always do. They're nearly all doing BAs in things like either fine art or surface pattern or illustration or those kind of things. I'm their pain in the arse. I'm the one that makes them write essays, you know, when they'd rather be in the studio making work.
Is it difficult to motivate?
Sometimes, yes. Yeah. I think one on cats might get them going. At least I'd have the cat lovers there anyway.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Don't think so, no.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.